It's Friday, August 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, the UN asks for a break in the fighting in Syria to deliver humanitarian aid.
Not one single convoy in 1 month has reached any of the humanitarian besieged areas.
Australian officials try to decide what to do with hundreds of asylum seekers at a controversial detention center. South Sudan's former vice president flees to Congo. And Brazilian police say American swimmers fabricated a story about being robbed. That's all on today's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. A senior UN official is calling for an immediate 48-hour pause in the fighting in Syria so desperately needed humanitarian assistance can be delivered to millions of people in Aleppo and other besieged areas. As Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, Special Envoy Staffan de Mistura says no aid has been able to reach desperately needy people for weeks.
The UN Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, abruptly suspended the regular weekly meeting of the International Syria Support Group's Humanitarian Access Task Force after 8 minutes.
I decided to use my privilege as chair to declare that there was no sense to have a humanitarian meeting today unless we got some action on the humanitarian side in Syria.
De Mistura noted the only action seen in Syria involves fighting, rockets, barrel bombing, chlorine and napalm attacks, suicide bombings, and other atrocities.
And in Syria, what we are hearing and seeing is only fighting, offensives, counteroffensives, rockets, barrel bombs, mortars, hellfire cannons, napalm, chlorine, snipers, airstrikes, suicide bombers. Not one single convoy in 1 month has reached any of the humanitarian besieged areas.
The one exception is the city of Deir ez-Zor, which is surrounded by Islamic State militants. De Mistura says the World Food Program has airdropped food supplies on 100 occasions to the 200,000 inhabitants of this area.
We ask for at least a pause of 48 hours. We insist on this in order to make anything meaningful for Aleppo. But the pause should also be accompanied by humanitarian aid, and that comes with it, and evacuation of medical cases.
De Mistura says he believes the United States and Russia, the two co-chairs of the humanitarian task force, are committed to finding a non-military solution to the Syrian conflict. But he admits he's concerned that this process is taking too long. He says more than 1 month has passed since U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov met in St. Petersburg to work out a cessation of hostilities. Unfortunately, he says, the hoped-for reduction of violence has not materialized. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, Thursday, the Russian military did say it was ready to back a UN call for a 48-hour ceasefire. Russian Defense Ministry spokesman Major General Igor Konashenkov says that Moscow would back the initiative on the condition that the aid convoys would travel to both rebel-controlled and government-controlled parts of Aleppo. Meanwhile, the Russian military says its warplanes flew from Iran for a third straight day to strike targets in Syria. The Russian Defense Ministry says bombers flew from bases in Russia and Iran on Thursday to target the Islamic State Group's facilities in Syria's eastern province of Deir ez-Zor. The human rights group Amnesty International says that more than 17,000 detainees have allegedly died in the Syrian government's custody over the past 5 years as a result of torture, disease, and other causes. Amnesty released a report which includes interviews with 65 torture survivors. The interviewees described abuse and inhuman conditions in security branches operated by Syrian intelligence agencies and in Saidnaya military prison near Damascus. Diana Simon is with Amnesty International's Middle East and North Africa program. She said the report highlights new statistics from the Human Rights Data Analysis Group, an organization that uses scientific approaches to analyze human rights violations.
We worked with the Human Rights Data Analysis Group that estimated that the number of people killed in detention is more than 17,000 Syrians. We believe, and the Human Rights Data Analysis Group, that this number is much higher because there are hundreds of thousands of people who are subjected to enforced disappearances. But we, based on the analysis that we have conducted, we can say that 17,000 people, more than 17,000 people, have been killed in detention.
The report says common methods of torture included forcibly contorting the victim's body into a tire and flogging the soles of their feet. It said authorities also used electric shocks, rape and sexual violence, the pulling out of fingernails or toenails, scalding with hot water, and cigarette burns. Freed prisoners have worked with forensic architects to recreate computer-generated models of what the prison looked like. Christina Varviva, that is, a project coordinator for forensic architecture, says the aim of the project is to help those who remain trapped in the prison.
What we're trying to do with this effort is try to build the story of this prison and try to speak up for all these people who are still in there, because this is not something that is finished.
Philip Luther is director of Amnesty International's Middle East and North Africa program. He says the international community needs to bring these abuses, to attention of all sides in the civil war.
Overall, everything about Sidnaya Prison serves to destroy the detainee. The conditions, and they are horrendous conditions, the torture, and there are a range of torture techniques, particularly beatings, but also then acts of cruelty and humiliation that detainees face on a daily basis. People come out broken, if they come out at all.
Diana Simon says the international community has, so far, mostly turned away from the abuses.
So far, we haven't seen any kind of accountability against the perpetrators of torture and ill-treatment in Syrian prisons. Russia and China have blocked any kind of initiative for referring the situation in Syria to the ICC. Amnesty International is calling on the international community, in particular Russia and the U.S., to prioritize the issue of detention in the peace talks and to pressure the Syrian government to end these practices of torture and ill-treatment that amounts to crimes against humanity.
The abuses date back to the start of the Syrian uprising against President Bashar al-Assad in March of 2011. Time now to turn to look at what the World Wide Web is saying about this subject and other matters. That's because G. Abby Lee, our social media reporter, joins us in the studio. G., what have we got today?
Hi, Dave. So as you have probably seen, there is a picture of a Syrian boy in Aleppo who just got pulled out of a rubble and being photographed with dust and blood all over his head. That's been trending. And you can also check it out on our website at voanews.com. His name is Omran Dakhnish, and there's also a video of him released by the Aleppo Media Center, and that's really raising awareness of what's going on in Aleppo, Syria. Have you checked it out?
I have seen that. I've seen a still of it. I've also seen the video. He apparently was pulled out from underneath a collapsed building
Absolutely.
By rescuers, so it's a very powerful image.
And if you look at the social media reaction, some people are arguing that the Obama administration is to blame for its foreign policy exacerbating the situation in the Middle East. And some people are saying that it's quite ironic when in one part of the world there is an Olympics game going on that highlights unity and peace, but in Syria it's all about destruction and children are being sacrificed.
Very powerful image.
Now, turning to what's happening in America, Trump's most visible child, his daughter Ivanka Trump, is trending because she's in the hot seat, or rather the company that she patronizes in the hot seat for a little bit of a political story here. So she placed an order for a pair of ear cuffs, and then the company that catered to her wrote this and posted the reaction on Instagram. It wrote, "Dear Ivanka, thank you so much for your web order, blah, 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 and we're happy to let you know that the proceeds of your sale have been generously donated to the American Immigration Council, the Every Town for Gun Safety Organization, and the Hillary Clinton campaign. We hope you enjoy.
Oh,
that's
boy.
All for me today.
All right, thanks, G. You can follow G on Twitter. She is at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories in Asia, Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi began her visit to China Thursday, but her efforts to bolster ties with her country's dominant northern neighbor could hinge on whether she can resolve the fate of a massive Chinese-funded dam project. South Korea's army conducted its largest ever artillery drills near the tense border with the north, but there was no immediate military response from the north. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte says he will not raise long-simmering maritime disputes with China at a meeting of Southeast Asian nations in Laos next month. Two Indonesian sailors making a daring escape from Abu Sayyaf militants in the southern Philippines have spent almost 2 months in captivity. And Vietnam lifts its sudden ban on veterans who traveled to the country to mark the 50th anniversary of Australia's most costly battle of the Vietnam War. You can find more on these stories by visiting our website, voanews.com. Australian officials are trying to decide what to do with hundreds of asylum seekers at a controversial detention center it has agreed to close in Papua New Guinea. New Guinea's Supreme Court ruled in April that the camp on Manus Island, one of two Australian-run immigration facilities in the South Pacific, was unconstitutional. Phil Mercer has more.
The closure of the Manus Island facility was announced Wednesday in a statement by PNG Prime Minister Peter O'Neill, who said an agreement had been reached after meeting with Australian Immigration Minister Peter Dutton in Port Moresby. The question now is what happens to the 850 men housed at the facility. Senior officials in Canberra say the detention centre won't close immediately, and they say the migrants won't be resettled in Australia. Most are from Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq and Syria, so voluntary repatriation is considered by rights groups to be unlikely. They could be transferred to a second offshore processing camp sponsored by Australia on Nauru, a tiny island where there have been recent allegations of widespread abuse of inmates, including children. In the past, Canberra has asked Cambodia and Malaysia to take in asylum seekers. New Zealand has also offered to resettle detainees held in Australia's offshore camps. Australian Immigration Minister Peter Dutton hopes that many of those housed on Manus Island will decide to go home voluntarily, as has been the case in the past.
We provide thousands of dollars of taxpayers' assistance to provide packages of support to help those people return back to their country of origin, and many hundreds have done that. Now, in cases like Sri Lanka, Vietnam, other countries like India, we have arrangements where if people refuse to go home, if they've been found not to be refugees, they can be forcibly returned. With Iran, for example, that's not the case. They'll take voluntary but not involuntary returns, and many hundreds have returned voluntarily to Iran, but people are making a decision in Manus on Nauru at the moment to say that they don't want to return, even if they've been found not to be a refugee, and we can't accept that situation.
In April, judges in Papua New Guinea said holding detainees on Manus Island was illegal. At a senior ministers' meeting Wednesday in the capital Port Moresby, there was an acknowledgement by both Australia and Papua New Guinea that the court's decision was final and the camp would close, although no date has been set. Asylum seekers who arrive in Australian waters by boat are sent to immigration facilities in the South Pacific, where their refugee claims are assessed. Canberra insists its policy of sending asylum seekers offshore is saving lives at sea by deterring other migrants. Refugee campaigners, though, say conditions in the centres are inhumane and that Australia is turning its back on the desperate and vulnerable. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
South Sudan's former first vice president, Riek Machar, has fled to neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, where he might be ill. As VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reports, Machar and his family fled to the DRC Wednesday and were taken in by UN peacekeepers.
UN spokesman Farhan Haq told reporters that Machar and a small group of people turned up in the DRC on Wednesday. The UN mission there, known as MINUSCO, was alerted to his presence and contacted the Congolese government. The government asked them to facilitate the group's transfer from an area near the DRC-South Sudan border to a location inside Congo, which the UN has not revealed.
We can confirm that an operation was undertaken by MINUSCO on humanitarian grounds to facilitate the extraction of Riek Machar, his wife, and 10 others from a location in the DRC in support of the DRC authorities.
Haq said that the UN mission in South Sudan played no part in Machar's arrival in the DRC. Asked whether Machar required medical care, Haq said, "We have been providing him with whatever medical assistance he needs." Sources tell VOA that the former leader was either ill, injured, or possibly both when peacekeepers met him in the DRC. Machar has been in hiding since early July following clashes between his supporters and government troops in South Sudan's capital, Juba, that killed more than 300 people. President Salva Kiir fired Machar as first vice president and replaced him with Taban Dengai, who was backed by a breakaway faction of Machar's SPLM-IO movement. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Coming up on International Edition, was it a case of boys being boys in Rio? Find out. This is VOA News.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The U.S. State Department has said a $400 million cash payment to Iran was contingent on the release of American prisoners. Spokesman John Kirby said Thursday that negotiations over the United States' return of Iranian money from a decades-old account was conducted separately from the prisoner talks.
We were able to conclude multiple strands of diplomacy within a 24-hour period, including implementation of the nuclear deal, the prisoner talks, and the settlement of an outstanding Hague Tribunal claim, which saved American taxpayers potentially billions of dollars. As we said at the time, we deliberately leveraged that moment to finalize these outstanding issues nearly simultaneously. It's already publicly known that we returned to Iran its $400 million in that same time period as part of the Hague settlement agreement.
Kirby did say the U.S. withheld delivery of the cash as leverage until the U.S. citizens had left Iran. Both events occurred on the 17th of January. Kirby spoke after the Wall Street Journal reported that the departures of the crisscrossing planes were linked. In the race for U.S. president, both candidates met with law enforcement officials on Thursday. Republican nominee Donald Trump met with officials in North Carolina. Democrat Hillary Clinton met with chiefs of police and sheriffs in New York. Clinton told the high-ranking officers in New York City, including outgoing New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton, that difficult work is ahead to reforge the bonds between law enforcement and the communities it is sworn to protect.
I think it's obvious that recent events from Dallas and Baton Rouge to Milwaukee and across the country underscore how difficult and important the work is ahead of us to repair the bonds of trust and respect between our police officers and our communities. We have to be clear-eyed about the challenges we face. We can't ignore them, and certainly we must not inflame them. We need to work together to bridge our divides, not stoke even more divisiveness.
Republican nominee Donald Trump met with Fraternal Order of Police officials in North Carolina. He told them their vote for him in November could be unanimous. That could be no matter where you go in the country, we may get no negative vote. The Republican nominee has called himself the law and order candidate and stopped by the local FOP lodge's gun range before he met with the officers. Brazilian police say that gold medal-winning swimmer Ryan Lochte and three of his teammates fabricated a story about being robbed in Rio de Janeiro to cover up their vandalization of a gas station after partying. Speaking through a translator, Rio Chief of Civil Police Fernando Veloso said Thursday that Lochte and his teammates, James Fegan, Jack Conger, and Gunnar Bentz, stopped at a gas station early in the morning on their way back to the Olympic compound. The four athletes had been drinking and, according to police sources, broke a bathroom door after finding it locked.
Right now, as we speak, what the police can affirm, there was no robbery as the way it was reported or claimed by the athletes. They were not victims of the criminal actions that they claim they were. The police can affirm that.
The Rio police chief said that the four athletes were confronted at gunpoint by security guards and the gas station owner, who said that they should pay for the damage.
So those vandalist attitudes or behavior created a damage to the gas station. They had to pay for that. So they offered to pay, and actually they paid with a $20 bill and a 100 reais bill.
Mario Andrada, a spokesman for the Rio 2016 organizing committee, said the athletes should be given the benefit of the doubt and the incident should not be blown out of proportion.
You know, let's give these kids a break. You know, they, you know, sometimes you take actions that you later regret. They are magnificent athletes. Lochte is one of the best swimmers of all times. You know, they had fun. They made a mistake. It's part of life. Life goes on. Let's go.
Brazilian authorities say that the swimmers could still be charged with vandalism and filing a false police report. Ryan Lochte's father has said that his son returned to the United States earlier this week. Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook. We're at VOA Now. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at VOA_IE. Tracy Carter directed our program. Carl Starling was our engineer. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Senior officials from the U.S. Embassy in Vientiane and U.S. Pacific Command, or USPACOM, met in Honolulu with senior officials from the Lao Ministry of National Defense for the 11th Lao-United States Bilateral Defense Dialogue. Brigadier General Ken Chan Nantalasi, Director of Foreign Relations Department, Ministry of National Defense, and Brigadier General Mark Gillette, Deputy Director of USPACOM Directorate for Strategic Plans and Policy, led the meeting. Over 30 Lao and U.S. delegates participated in the event, including representatives from the Lao Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Defense Security Cooperation Agency in Washington, D.C. Ambassador Daniel Kluh noted in his opening remarks the significant expansion of bilateral military cooperation in recent years and the positive impact it is having on the overall U.S.-Lao relationship. The Bilateral Defense Dialogue is a forum for bilateral consultations between the Lao Ministry of National Defense and U.S. Pacific Command to strengthen bilateral and multilateral cooperation, as well as develop defense cooperation programs that enhance relations between our security forces, encourage greater regional military cooperation, and promote the common interests of both countries. Primary topics of the dialogue included military medical cooperation, civil military operations to include cooperation on humanitarian unexploded ordnance removal and disaster relief, training and education opportunities to include English language training and professional military education, and Lao People's Army participation in regional conferences, workshops, and senior-level meetings. The United States is proud to work with its partner Laos for the benefit of both nations and the Asia-Pacific region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.